Okay. My name is Sean Allen, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know where the hell I am. I got up at 4 o'clock this morning, and I've been hurtling through the air ever since. I've gone through 3 time zones, and I don't know what I know or what I think. So you're liable to get the truth tonight. I have to make amends. I hate making amends. I mean, when you've been sober this long, you're supposed to be past that step. I keep having to come back to it all the time. If you've noticed some of the committee members a little nervous, you may not have. If you're as self-obsessed as I am, you probably didn't notice. But anyway, I was asked to be at this conference a year and a half ago. And I wrote it down in my book. And then I transferred it this year to my new day runner. And then I wrote it in my weekly book. And I got it all down just right. And they sent me a ticket, and I looked at that ticket 5 times. And I was all prepared to come to the conference. And last night at 6:30, my wife, the Al-Anon, of course, he had to get the Al-Anon. Tim called and said, is Sean on his way here? She said, no, he's on his way to the North Shore Roundup in Vancouver. She said he sounded like the guy was being strangled at the other end of the line. But we got a hold of each other, and I had written it down wrong. Well, I think I wrote it down wrong. Now, I'm making amends, but I just got to say something. I mean, I mean, for all of you people to get together and decide to change the date of this conference from next weekend to this weekend without telling me, I think you owe me an amend. That's how I like to make amends. Make it your fault. I called American Airlines. Now, my sobriety date is April 24th, 1974. And if I'd have known I was going to be sober this long, I'd have been a much better example, believe me. Anyway, you know, if anybody out there thinks I'm really something, raise your standards. Because I got on the phone to American Airlines, and this charming little lady at the end of the 800 number, I said, I had a reservation to fly out Friday, yep, today, and I missed it. And she said, was it because of medical reasons? And I said, yep. I mean, the lie was out there before I even knew what I had said. And she said, well, what kind of medical reasons? And I said, well, it wasn't me personally. It was a close personal friend. I mean, the trouble is? The trouble is, if you stay sober long enough, you turn into the world's worst liar. You lose all those skills that you took years to develop, you know? Before I knew it, I was into this incredible story with a woman at the end of an 800 number who I didn't know. I don't care what she thinks of me. Finally, I said, listen, I have to tell you something. I have to speak at a conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, oh, really? I said, it is terribly, and there are all kinds of medical reasons. I didn't know. On and on and on and on. And then when you're one of these big deal speaker things, like I'm supposed to be, I called Tim to get me out of it. And he put Barbara on the line. Barbara works for American Airlines. And she was at the computer, and she said, my mic's come up in the computer that you had some medical problems. Now, I know she's sitting next to Tim. And I said, well, yeah, that's what I told him. And Barbara did that thing that my sponsor does to me. She said, you didn't have to do that. Well, I know that. I don't need to be told that. So she said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And then she lied, so I'm fine. But God got me. Because on the leg from Dallas to here, the pilot got the timing. I've been through, I don't know how many time zones. But anyway, he got the last time zone wrong, and he said, we will be arriving at approximately 7:30. So I jumped up from row 12. And they're coming down with the coffee and the sandwiches. Can I get anything for you? And I get my hanging thing and my overnight thing, and I'm going down to the end of the thing. And I changed into this in one of those little tiny rooms. Out of blue jeans and a sweatshirt into this. And I shaved, too. It's not easy being in one of those little things when you're 6'2 and weigh over 200 pounds, which Irish Annie pointed out to me. I said, Annie, you look so thin. She said, that's because you're so fat. Practicing the principles of rigorous honesty, she is. I came out of that little cubicle, and the stewardess said, my, it smells nice in there. I said, you should have smelled it a couple of minutes ago, honey. Oh, God, what a wild day. I love being sober. I mean, you know, this is like an e-ticket at Disneyland. I mean, this is excitement. I thought once I stopped drinking, it was going to be so boring, you know. Just going to kind of sit around in AA meetings, you know, talk about the principles. I didn't know I get to break them a lot. Well, anyway, that's how spiritually evolved I am. And if you think I'm bad now, you should have seen me when I came in. Alcoholics Anonymous has absolutely saved my life. It has made it. Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety is the springboard for my life, and my life is so exciting. I mean, it just is incredible. Even when it's lousy, it's exciting. Even when it's lousy, it's terrific because of the principles and because of what you've taught me. In April I'll be 18 years sober, and that's a landmark birthday for somebody like me, because what that will mean is by the time I celebrate that birthday, I will have been sober longer than I drank. And that's pretty exciting for somebody like me who had no idea that I would ever stop drinking. I never quit drinking until the night before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank right up until the night before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on April 24th, 1974, it has not been necessary for me to drink or have any self-administered mind-altering chemicals. And that's impossible for somebody like me. So what you're looking at is a miracle, granted a little shabby, but there you have it. I developed the conditions that made drinking work for me. But I got to tell you something. I love being sober, but I love being loaded. I mean, I didn't come here instead of going to the gym, you know. I absolutely love getting bombed, blasted, ripped to the tits, everything. I loved it. Everything. Smashed, boxed, you name it. All I ever wanted out of life was out. And see, the thing about drinking for me, I don't know about you, but it worked every time I did it. From the first time I got drunk until the last time I got drunk. There was a moment every time that I drank that it all came together. You know? Where I was like Cary Grant and James Dean. You know? Where I was kind of sexy but sensitive. You know? Kind of tough but poetic. You know, a terrific dancer, but a tough guy. It all worked. There was a moment every time I did it where I was dazzling. And it happened the first night I got loaded, and I loved it. And from that time on, I pursued it. But I got right into the great obsession, just like that, first night I got drunk. And what happened is I achieved that moment every time it happened. I just kept paying a higher and higher and higher price. So that eventually, every time I got drunk, it was eventually like being dragged face down a gravel driveway. You know, that's how it kind of ended up for me all the time. I remember once being invited to a really nice house party at a beach one time. And it started off so swell. One of the things, see, I've always felt that if you're well-dressed, nobody knew that you were a complete nincompoop. And so I don't really wear clothes. I wear costumes, you see. So I had been invited to this beach party, so I had like white slacks on and white, I looked like an ad for some Smirnoff, you know, at the beginning of the evening. The party took place on a Saturday night, and at noon on Sunday, I came too, in a pair of shorts, undershorts, not bathing shorts, on the beach. And I had passed out, and it was high noon, it was a very hot day, and I had passed out, and half of me was buried in the sand. Now, I'm kind of fair-skinned, so the other side of me looked like a lobster. So I had to walk around for the next week and a half with one half of me looking like a lobster and the other half of me all pockmarked from the sand, you know. That's how drinking was for me. I should have learned, you know, but I never got it. I never got it. What's important to me these days is the 12th step and the 12 traditions. But particularly the 12th step and particularly the 12th tradition. Because They kind of are a culmination of stuff for me. The 12th step talks about having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And I've taken the steps over and over and over again because I'm not very bright. You're not looking at a rocket scientist here, you know, or a real deep thinker. What you're looking at is a pretty average drunk who burned out a lot of synapses with a lot of cheap vodka. So I got to be told it over and over and over again because I just don't get it. I can't remember pain. I can't remember pain, you know? So you got to keep telling me what to do. So I've taken the steps over and over and over and over and over again. And the 12th step talks about having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And the 12th step has got three parts to it. And we always think the 12th step is just kind of, you know, telling people our story, and what I'm doing here tonight, let me tell you, is the least important 12-step work there is in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you, it is real easy for me to stand here in my spiffy suit and sound great in Little Rock, Arkansas. It is easy, man. What's not easy is how I am in my den at home, you know, when the kid has just put a peanut butter sandwich on the television screen. You know. Or my Al-Anon is releasing me. And you should see what a spiffy program I got on the freeway. But having had a spiritual awakening is the promise in the second step. And the second step is that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And because I've worked the 12 steps, now that I am at the 12th step, I can no longer cop to being crazy. You know? Because the 12 steps do it. They restore us to sanity. And the thing that does it is that spiritual awakening. If you hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have got 4 or 5 years of sobriety talking about, oh, I'm so crazy. I just shot my mother. I'm so crazy. That's a lie. That's a lie. I am not crazy anymore. I'm self-obsessed. I'm selfish, I'm self-righteous, I'm self-destructive, I'm self, but I'm not crazy. I can't get away with it anymore. It's no longer beyond my control. It's no longer some psychological thing. It's just that I am much more interested in me than I am in you. That's why I've been in service for a long time. I'm going to get it sooner or later so I can get out. Damn. I'd like a lot of my problems to be kind of psychological. I'm shy. I am. What I've done to overcompensate for it appalls me, but I'm I always have been. I've spent my whole life overcompensating for me. I get to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and in Southern California you drive a lot, and if you recognize my car, you'd see me pull into the parking lot of the church hall, you know, and I'd sit there in my car for a few minutes. You think, isn't that wonderful? Sean's getting his spiritual message together. And what I'm doing is I'm sitting in my car saying, you've got to get out of this car, Sean. They've seen you. You can't drive away. You got to get out of the car. Yeah. Because I'm shy. I would like shyness to be a psychological disorder. I would like it to be kind of something beyond anything I could do anything about. You know, matter of fact, I'd kind of like to start a 12-step program for shy people. I think we need another one. I think we've only got about 635. I think we need another 12-step program for shy people. SA. Be great. They'd be real quiet meetings because he would be too shy to talk. You know? And they'd be real small. People would be too shy to come. And we could talk about the reasons why we're shy. You know, that our parents did something or other to us. But, didn't they do it all to us? But I'm not psychologically disordered in that way. What shyness is to me is extreme self-obsession. What is it that I'm so concerned with the effect that I'm going to have on you that I don't do anything? You know? What I learned a long time ago was the tyranny of the passive personality. If I stand in a corner and you walk over to me, I own you. I can't get up enough to walk over to you. The wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is our sponsors force us to do stuff to break down that self-obsession. One of the first jobs that I had to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I arrived at my first meeting in a sports jacket. I was always kind of well dressed. People thought I had more sobriety than than I did until they talked to me, and then they went, "Whoa!" The old timers running around going, "Ah!" But because I had a sports jacket on, and they made me shake hands at the door of Sunday Night Normandy meeting. Oh God, I hated that. I would have rather eaten ground glass than shake hands at a door. It's just terrifying. But my sponsor made me do it, and he didn't tell me why he made me do it. And I'm real glad he didn't, because if he'd have told me, I wouldn't have done it. But see, when I'm in my parking lot and I'm sitting there saying, you got to get out of this car, what I do is I eventually get out of the car because I can't drive away because they've seen me. And I walk up to the door, and some poor slob whose sponsor made him do it, he's standing at the door, and he sticks out his hand and says, "Hi, my name is Fred." And what he does is he takes my hand and he pulls me through the door. And he doesn't know he's doing that. And he doesn't know that that's an act of love, but that's what it is. And those are the kind of stuff you learn in Alcoholics Anonymous without knowing that you learned it. So that my shyness has been overcompensated by the fact that if being involved with service and learning the traditions, I have come to understand that collectively your sobriety is more important than mine. And that you are the only people who have ever been able to teach me anything. And so I keep coming back to you because you're the only resource that has ever made any sense to me. I realized real fast that I was in trouble. Real fast. I started getting drunk when I was 14 years old. I started taking drugs when I was 17 years old. And when I was 18 years old, I declared myself an alcoholic. Now, I don't know if anybody here is insured that you're in the right place. Although I don't know why a social drinker would end up here. But I said the phrase at 18 years old that only an alcoholic says, and if you've ever said it, you're an alcoholic. If you've ever heard anybody say it, you're looking at an alcoholic, and that phrase is, I can control my drinking. Simple test. Only an alcoholic says that phrase. Social drinkers never deal with that concept. Social drinkers, if they get into trouble with drinking, if they do something really foolish or outrageous, they stop drinking. Isn't that weird? Can you imagine? But I was 18 years old and I was in trouble with the chemicals, but the prospect of living without them was even more terrifying. That's alcoholism. And so I started on the great obsession of every abnormal drinker to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know about you, but I have never sipped anything in my entire life. I don't to this day. You know. Now that I'm sober, I'm healthy. I'm real healthy. I live with an Al-Anon. And let me tell you, I love Al-Anon. I love Al-Anon. She went to Al-Anon a week after I got sober, and she's been an active member of Al-Anon for almost 18 years, and she is fabulous, and I had nothing to do with it. But she's not a drinker, and she never took pills, so it's real funny. When Bonnie gets a cold, she gets a vitamin C tablet, and she gets about a half a gallon of water. And she puts a vitamin C tablet in her mouth, and she drinks about a half a gallon of water, get the thing down, she goes, I mean, it's really weird to watch her. Now, I get up in the morning, and I got my vitamins, because I'm into health. I got a roll of vitamins like this. So I get my hand out, and I go, I got a big mound, you know? And then I go, and I'm ready to go. That's how I am. I drink coffee like they're shot glasses. That's how I drink them. Bonnie occasionally has an Al-Anon party at our house. I love them. 35 Al-Anons get together and split a bottle of wine. And then they argue about who's going to take what's left over home. I love watching those. And they'll say, no, I can't take it home. My husband's new. Well, I never use it. Oh, I don't know. It always just turns to vinegar at our house. And they just go around and around and around and around. And finally, one of them will say, oh, for God's sake, I'll take it home. And then you can see 34 little minds go, and they all think, I wonder if she's in the right program. I come home sometimes after Al-Anon parties and it looks like nobody's been there. 35 people have been there and it looks like nothing happened, you know? I say, what's the matter, honey? Was the party canceled? Oh, no, we were all here and we had a lot of fun. Now, when I have parties and we have a lot of fun, all the windows are blown out. You know? And it looks like somebody started a fire in a corner of the room. Those are social drinkers. They're the strangest bunch I've ever met. So I was 18 years old and in trouble. So I started controlling and enjoying. Now, when I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying it. I hate controlling my drinking. And when I'm enjoying my drinking, it's wildly out of control. I mean, that's how I drink. Wah! You know? So I did that as long as I could. By the time I was 24 years old, I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I picked up a little non-habit-forming marijuana habit. And I was working the docks. The doctors. Oh, God, love the doctors. Those jerks. I think it's silly to buy drugs in alleys. I mean, you know, you can get your shoes wet. You know? I like waiting rooms. I like prescription pads. Now, what I did in my early 20s was I got a medical book and memorized symptoms for the kind of drugs I wanted. And then I went to the doctors and told them I had these symptoms, and they wrote me the prescriptions. I went to 3 of them at all times. So I always had a lot of them. I love those things. Because what they did was, see, I was a lousy drinker. I got very drunk very fast and very little, but when I took a certain combination of outside issues, I could just stay up all night and do it all. So I did as long as I could. But by the time I was 24, I was in trouble, so I decided I needed a good woman, so I found her in an elevator. She was a little dancer. She was blonde and had a little dimple. She was the cutest thing I ever saw. And I noticed her right off the bat. But she didn't notice me until 3 days later when my back went out and I crawled into rehearsal and zing went the strings of her heart. We were doing a show together. I didn't realize that for an Al-Anon, a drunk crawling across a hotel lobby was like coming home. There was something in her eyes, and I recognized that. I looked at her, and she looked at me, and I thought, if I ever get involved with this woman, I'll never get uninvolved. I was right. What I didn't realize what it was is there's an incredible look in an Al-Anon's eyes when they recognize potential. It's terrifying. It's terrifying. So we started our dance of death. We've been together 22 years. And I like her. I respect her. I'm crazy about her. I really. She's just spiffy. She pisses me off more than anybody I've ever known in my life. God damn. That woman works one of those programs where she just looks at you and says occasionally stuff like, "This behavior is unacceptable." I hate that. I hate that. Because it usually is. It's really wonderful being in love with an equal. It really is. It really is terrific. Anyway, we got married, and she settled down. And then she noticed that I drank too much, and all hell broke loose. And on April 23rd, 1974, I got arrested by the West Hollywood Vice Squad on a sleazy charge and was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance with the front of my pants from the waistband to the knees soaked in my own urine. And it got my attention. And there's a moment in every alcoholic's life when stuff comes crystal clear. That terrible moment. That awful, awful moment when you just see it and know it. And there's this kind of breach in the denial, but it slams closed real fast. If you don't act on it at that moment, sometimes you never get that moment again. And you never see it again, and the denial will kill you. But I saw it, thank God. I saw that there was a terrible gap between who I was and who I wanted to be, and I couldn't be that. I knew who I wanted to be. I knew what the principles were that I was supposed to be living my life, and that I was living outside of my principles. That I was living a life that I personally did not approve of, even though I had managed to fool you that I was a nice guy. And I realized that I had committed suicide of the soul. And I understood at a very deep level that my life, as I understood it, was over. But I was not going to die. And I never want to feel like that again as long as I live. And I went to a woman I'd been working with for a year. And she had 6 years of sobriety. And she was active in this fellowship. And this is where the second part of the 12th step comes in. She carried the message. What she did was she told me her story. You know, I think a lot of us in this, now that the insurance companies have found out we're big business, have forgotten what 12-step work is. 12-step work is not driving somebody to a treatment center. That's being a cab driver. But 12-step work is one drunk talking to another drunk who wants to stop drinking. And it's something that, that all of us are suffering from the lack of an opportunity to do these days. The amount of 12-step calls that are coming into AA central offices have dropped dramatically. And it's too bad. It's too bad because it's the thing that just is galvanizing when you're doing it. It makes you so grateful for who you are and what you got. And I didn't know that while she was doing it, but she told me her story, and she read to me from the big book. She read chapter 5, chapter 3, and the 12 traditions, and I thought, my God, that woman is going to read that entire book to me. She made me a sandwich, and she gave me something to drink. It was, I can still taste it. It was Carol syrup and orange juice. And she told me it would calm me down, and it did. And she took me to my first meeting, and I've been going ever since. And that's the middle part of the 12th step. And I do that kind of stuff whenever I have the opportunity to do it. I'm not so good at 12-step work anymore because I've got almost 18 years of sobriety, and newcomers don't know what that means. I've been on 12-step. I always take somebody with me who's got 6 months or 3 months now, you know, because you go and you know, and I lay the spiritual message on the guy. Talk about the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and the concepts. And he'll say, how long have you been sober? And I say, April 24th, it'll be 18 years. And you see him go. The smoke starts coming out of his ear, you know. He doesn't even know. You think, oh, God, you know. And then he turns to the guy next to me and says, how long have you been sober? He says, 3 months. He said, how'd you do it? And then they start talking about the program, and I do what I've always done in 12-step calls, which is I clean up the apartment. I wash dishes and make beds and get it all cleaned up, you know, while the guy's getting the message. The hard one about the 12-step is a little thing at the end that so many of us ignore, and that is to practice the principles in all our affairs. And I got to look how I'm doing it. And I got to tell you, I did it lousy last night. I got to look at my honesty and my open-mindedness and my willingness, which are the basic principles of the entire 12 steps. How do I apply them in the workplace? How do I apply them at home? How do I apply them with my mother who doesn't care about my... She's kind of embarrassed that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Doesn't really want to talk about it. How do I do it with all those small-minded people who don't understand me? And I got to look at that. I got to look at it because a couple of things have happened to me in the last couple of years that have been very, very important to me. I've been in a place or a time where somebody next to me has said, boy, would I love to quit drinking. And I've said, yeah, I know how you feel. I quit drinking about 18 years ago because I had to. I'm an alcoholic. The guy says, you're an alcoholic? They would never dream that I was an alcoholic, which is the most effective 12-step work you can do. Because sooner or later, we got to move out of this place. Sooner or later, we got to take this stuff and apply it out there. It's real easy to be a very big deal in AA. You know, don't work, hang around Alano clubs all the time, you know, go on 12-step, you know, be available to talk to everybody 24 hours a day. I had a sponsor like that. He ended up owing me $45,000. But he was a spiritual giant in AA. Sooner or later, we got to take these principles out there and become members of this community. We got to become anonymous. We got to become the 12th tradition, which talks about anonymity. Now, what I thought anonymity meant when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous was that we were a secret society, you know? And I got sober, like I said, before it got kind of chic, you know, before actresses who were having a bad time with their career checked into Betty Ford and turned it around, you know? It was still kind of sleazy to be in AA. I was embarrassed to be in AA for the first 2 years of my sobriety. I don't know why it was more embarrassing to be sober than it was to throw up on your Christmas tree, but there you have it. You know. I was none too tightly wrapped when I arrived here, you know. But it was kind of cheesy to be in AA, you know. We met in these kind of church basements with gray walls and low ceilings and filled with smoke, and everybody you would have drank with were there. Yeah. And that's what I thought this thing was. Anonymity meant that we were secret. And that isn't what it is at all. It took me a while into sobriety after working this stuff and being around you and being taught to find out that anonymity is a spiritual principle. And the 12 and 12 talks about it. It talks about the spiritual principle of anonymity and what is that. And the principle, of course, is humility. Now, I had humility and humiliation all mixed up together, and I knew a lot about humiliation, you know, when you do the kind of things that I do, when you wake up in the strange places with the even stranger people after having done really, truly bizarre things, you know a lot about humiliation. And that's what I thought. I thought humility was to be my punishment for the way I drank. And what I've come to find out is humility is nothing like that. Humility is I give up the need to distinguish myself, either within this fellowship or out there. Now, I am a person who believes that if I am not extraordinary, I am not anything. That's where I was coming from all my life. And I don't have a fabulous drunkalog. I never really did anything interesting, you know? I did a series of slimy, sleazy, cheesy, smarmy, lousy, cheap, crummy little things over and over and over again, interspersed with occasional spectacular achievements. And if you had ever seen those spectacular achievements, you might have thought that they were designed to convince you that I was better than you. And that was never true. I always thought if I did something incredible, you'd think that I was equal to you. And that's where I was coming from. Now, in sobriety, that didn't go away. I was determined to become the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous ever. You know? While being embarrassed to be here. Yeah? And over the years, and I don't know where it came from, I think it's because I was blessed with something when I first got sober. I was blessed with being afraid or a little in awe of the old-timers. And I used to just kind of... What I wanted to do was I wanted sobriety to be like a loose mantle. I wanted it to be part of me. Not something that I did day in and day out. Not something I worked at day in and day out. But that it would become part of my reaction, you know? That I would react sober. And so what I used to do when I was new, and I still do it, I'd kind of stand around where the old-timers were, you know? Kind of get up near them at the coffee and hope they didn't notice me, you know? And just kind of listen to them and watch them. And what I saw was that they had no kind of need to impose their ideas or their will or anything else on any other member of the program. What I saw was the principle of sharing that makes us anonymous. All my life when I was in trouble with drinking and using drugs, what I did was I went to moral superiors. I went to priests and brothers and nuns and monsignors and bishops and psychiatrists and sociologists and gurus and groups and doctors and lawyers and policemen and judges, and I would tell them my problems eventually. You know, we would get to it. The big breakdown moment. What's really going on is, you know. And they would listen to that crap. And then they would consult their books, because they all had diplomas and stuff, which impressed me. And they would consult their books and they'd say, this is what you should do about your problem. Well, somebody points their finger at me and says, this is what you should do about your problem. I bite it off to the second knuckle. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you said, this is what I've done about my problems. Take what you can use. Now, I can't fault that because that's experience. That sober experience. And that's what I listen for in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, religious dogma and psychological claptrap, that's fun. I mean, I'll be very glad to get into a discussion with how many angels can dance on the head of a pin anytime. I mean, that's bar talk and it's fun, and we do a lot of that kind of stuff in sobriety too. You know, analyzing what Bill Wilson really meant on page 32, you know. I'm sure he didn't know. But some guy says, you know, when I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be married, somebody asked John Ackerlin how he stayed married. And he said, I don't date other women. Why didn't I think of that? You know? That kind of stuff. That kind of stuff I hear around here. But that thing that I'm... that what I am is... the reason I'm talking here tonight is not because I am unusual, but because I'm typical. When I was newly sober, I went to my sponsor. I was about 4 months sober. 4 months was a big one. Congratulations to all of you who are new. You know, all of you who are in your first year. How do you like it so far? Right? One of the reasons that I have stayed sober this long, there are lots of reasons. I mean, there are lots of reasons why. But one of the big ones is I never want to have to get sober again as long as I live. I mean, it was the worst experience of my adult life. I don't know about yours. Yeah. 4 months was a biggie. 4 months I became impotent. Last thing I did really well. You know. No matter what, I can always get it up. Call my sponsor. He said, oh, hi, Sean, what's up? I said, nothing. So we talked about it. He said, don't worry, it happens to most guys, 4 to 6 months sober, it'll go away. If anybody here is 4 to 6 months sober, it goes away. I said, what about my wife? He said, she's probably relieved. But I also went to him about 4 months sober and I said, I'm in real trouble. He said, what now? And I said, I identify with the women when they talk. He said, that's because the women, when they share from the podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous, tend to talk about how they feel. When the men talk, they tend to talk about events. What you are identifying with are the feelings. Since you haven't had any in a number of years, you probably don't recognize them. He said, if you're ever asked to share from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is highly unlikely, because there is a difference between carrying the message and spreading the disease, talk about the feelings. And I've been trying to do that every time I've been asked. Because that's what locks us together. That's what makes us anonymous. I searched everywhere I could to find the solution to my problems, and I found them here because you had the miracle phrase. You said something that I had never heard anywhere, anytime, anywhere else. I told you what was going on, and you said, I know how you feel. As soon as somebody starts a response with, I know how you feel, I'm safe. I can listen. I can learn. And you've done that for over 17 years with me. Thank God. Thank you. Because that's what saved my life. I've always said, and I'm very grateful, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got struck stupid. Because I was so terrified that I could, it had to be real simple or I didn't get it. Now, if you knew, I got some bad news for you. There's no spiritual side to this program. The whole thing is spiritual. The whole package is spiritual. No side to it. It's not optional. I went to my sponsor, and he explained it to me. The first day that I was sober, he said, you got to search for God on a daily basis. You'll probably never find God, but you got to search. And I said, how do you do that? And he told me. I had to kneel down. Me. Kneel. Because he explained that I was one of the arrogant ones. Hurt my feelings. So I did it because I was scared of him. And so I get up in the morning, I go in the bathroom, I lock the bathroom door, and I get down on my knees, and I say, okay, God, keep me sober, and let me know what you want me to do today. And I get up and look around, and then open the bathroom door and pretend like I hadn't done it. You know? And then I go on the... at night and lock the bathroom door and get down on my knees and say, thank you, God, for keeping me sober, and get up and look around and act cool coming up. You know. I locked the bathroom door when I prayed. I left it open when I puked, but I lock it when I pray. And that was the extent of my, that was the start of my spiritual life. This search for some, I was raised an Irish Catholic, which is different from a Roman Catholic, but I, and by the time I was 24, I had broken all the Ten Commandments, which is a biggie for a former altar boy. And I had then I became an agnostic. I love agnostics. I was an agnostic, not out of conviction, but out of convenience. I was an agnostic because I was in deep shit with God, so I decided to demand further proof of his existence. Go ahead, strike me with lightning. I learned those two alcoholic prayers. The first one is, dear God, get me out of this and I will never do it again. And the second alcoholic prayer is, so that was my spiritual life when I arrived here, and it, you know, and then I started doing this stuff, and it embarrassed me, and I had my first spiritual experience when I was 6 months sober, and it's important to me to tell you about it. I tried as best I could to sleep through my entire first year of sobriety. I don't know about you, but if I couldn't get loaded, I was going to get out somehow. I mean, 24 hours of reality was way more than I could handle. I was a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife who worked. So I was in sales. So I got to take a lot of naps. And 6 months sober, I'm trying to take a nap. I couldn't. I was just furious. And I looked up at the ceiling and I said, I don't believe in you and I think you're a jerk. Then it occurred to me, if I didn't believe, who was I yelling at? And then being a good ex-Catholic, who if I had gotten hit by a bus and knew I was going to die would call a priest, I waited for 3 weeks to see if I was going to get punished for calling him a jerk. And I didn't. As a matter of fact, what happened is it broke a very old idea of God in me, and I didn't know that because I don't ever know what's going on with me at the moment. I don't know how I feel tonight. I'll tell you in a week when I come back for the conference. It broke an idea of a God that was out there and up there. And what started to form was a little microchip of God within me. You know, the idea that maybe I was carrying around something. The soul, what the nuns had talked about, but I couldn't hear it because there's something wrong with me and I can only be taught by you. And what I did was I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous and meetings and listening in a different way. And see, I'd been raised with the tradition that if it wasn't Lourdes, it wasn't a miracle. So I decided to lower my standards on miracles, and I started hearing stuff in AA meetings. People talking about putting families together and getting jobs and getting buying cars and paying their debts and staying out of jail. I mean, stuff that's impossible. And I started gathering up miracles, and it started shoring up an idea of God in me. When I was 8 years sober, after I'm skipping around here, I want you to think that this has just been a straight shot at serenity here, but it hasn't. 5 years sober, I screwed up my entire life, blew up my marriage, and we put it back together, and 8 years sober, my daughter was born. When I was 10 years sober, I was asked to share at a conference in Hawaii. The real speaker canceled, and so they called me and said, would you do it? And I said, oh, all right. Hawaii. Yeah. Well, we were broke. God, were we broke. I've been rich and I've been poor in Alcoholics Anonymous. I prefer the problems of being rich to the problems of being poor. But they all got problems. I found out that having money doesn't fix you and doesn't protect you. I was disappointed to find that out. Anyway, we were in our poor phase. My sponsor who taught me all this good stuff had borrowed some money. I came to find out that the guy who taught me everything didn't have a seventh tradition or a tenth step. We learn interesting things from our sponsors. We learn how to work the program, and we also learn how not to work the program. I think I teach that to my guys, too. How to work the program and how not to work the program. Anyway, I went to work the next day, and I told the guy that I was working with that I was going to go to Hawaii to this conference, and he said, gee, my mother has a condominium over there. You can use it for a week if you want. She's never there. I don't know where it is. It turned out to be 500 yards away from where the conference was. And out of the blue, a check came for a job that I'd done years before, and it was the exact amount of money for a round-trip fare for Bonnie to go. And Kate was to travel the day before her second birthday, so she went for free. And there we were in Hawaii. And it was Kate's birthday. And I took Kate down to the beach, because Bonnie was making up a little party. And there I was on the beach with my little red-headed girl. I have pictures. You have beautiful and intelligent children, but I have Kate. She's almost 9 years old, and I still go into her bedroom and watch her sleep. She occasionally wakes up and goes, what are you doing in here?
Never mind.
But she was two, and we were at this beach, and there was miles of white sand with nobody else on the beach. It was about 6 o'clock at night. And this turquoise water lapping in, and my little two-year-old is running in and out of the water, lapping and squealing like a little two-year-old will do. And her hair was the color of the sunset. And I realized I was standing in the middle of a dream. And you know, they tell you when you're new not to make any plans. And the reason is that when you're new, your horizons are hemmed in by fear. You know? And we make these little tiny plans. I heard it in Texas. This woman was sharing at a meeting. She said, the reason we tell newcomers not to make any plans is because we're afraid that's all they'll get. You know? And I realized I was standing in the middle of a dream, that this was a scene that I couldn't conceive of when I was new. And even if I could have conceived of it, I wouldn't have dared dream it, because it would have been just taking God's goodwill just too far. I didn't know that I was capable of loving this much, and something happened there in my relationship to God that I didn't know for a couple of years later. What happened there is I love Kate with my whole heart and my whole soul, and I don't love her because she's perfect. I love her because she's mine. That's all. And I don't have much of a capacity to love. I'm too selfish. I'm not very bright. I'm not... In the middle of me, there's something cold, you know? But if I'm capable of loving a child that unconditionally, and if I'm a child of God, I wonder what God's capable of. You know? I wonder what God's capable of. Because they talk about us being created in God's image, and I don't believe it's the way we look. I mean, look around these rooms. I believe the image we're created in is God, is when we're loving. You know? I believe when we're loving, we look like God. And I can see it in AA meetings. I can see it when some little old lady says to some punk 15-year-old with a safety pin stuck in her nose and a black leather jacket, come sit next to me, dear. I can see the family resemblance. I can see it when somebody gets on the bus and goes across town to get the literature and takes the bus all the way back with a big cardboard box full of it. I can see the family resemblance. I can see how they look like God. I can see it when the guy gets there at 6 o'clock at night and puts the coffee on so that the coffee's there for 8 o'clock meeting. I can see the family resemblance. I can see it all over these rooms. And because of that, I have strongly come to believe. And I spent my life making deals with God. I spent my life on my knees trying to change God's mind
You know, just give me a break, man. Just make an exception in this case. Yeah. And what I've come to find out as far as coming to understand God is that I've got to move out of me. I've got to move in that direction. I can't ask God to become diminished enough for me to understand. And I found it in a strange way. I found it in being asked to come to these kind of things. Being asked to be at conventions and have the host who doesn't know what the hell to do with a speaker take you around the city. There we have the town hall, and there we have the museum. There we have. But what's happened is I have come to see the great rivers in America. I've come to see the Columbia, and the Mississippi, and the Ohio. I've seen those great wide rivers that just move quietly in a direction. They just move with this kind of force. And you know what? My experience with God has been a little pool at the edge of that. A little one that I found that if I stuck my finger in, I could change the direction of. And I took that as my spiritual life. And what you've taught me is to look up. To look up across that river and watch it move. The direction of something beyond me. And my responsibility is to get my little boat out of the middle and then just quit paddling. And just go with it. And be taken to where I'm supposed to go. And that's made it easy for me. And that's made it comfortable for me. And that's made it safe for me. My life is extraordinary. A couple of years ago, I had the most significant success of my life. I mean, a thing beyond anything that I ever dreamed of, I got to do. It was exciting. It was glamorous. It was incredible. And I got to see the fruition of a dream in reality, a great moment in my life. I mean, and I was grateful for it. And about that time, there was a girl in our group. And because I have learned to be teachable, I not only taught by the people who have more experience than me, but I've allowed myself to be taught by the people who have less. The new people can teach me too, and that's a change in me, because there was an arrogance in me that said I could have, you know, I only looked to the old timers. But people all over Alcoholics Anonymous can teach me, and there's a girl in our group. And she's fun and she's bright. She's like a Southern California girl. She's just, you know, she's just out there. She was a party girl and just crashed and burned and crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we identify with each other. And I walked into a meeting one day, and she was real quiet. And I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Oh, nothing." And I said, "Come on." Now, I've been around a while, and Linda's a little afraid of me. So I started digging. And I said, "What's going on?" She said, "Well, I've been seeing a doctor," and I said, "What's going on, Linda?" And she said, "Well, I've got some medical problems." I said, "What kind of medical problems, Linda?" She said, "Well, they did some tests." I said, "What kind of tests, Linda?" And she said, "Well, they did a biopsy." And I said, "And what was the result of the biopsy?" And she said, "Well, there's a malignancy." I said, "What does that mean?" And she said, "Well, it means a malignancy." I said, "What is the word? Say the word." And she said, "I got cancer." And I said, "Okay. Now, you said that. If you're asked to share from a podium in the next little while, I want you to get up at that podium and talk about what the hell is going on with you right this second. Talk about it." Now, a lot of people who say, "Now, what has that got to do with alcoholism? All we do is talk about alcohol from the bullshit." We talk about life, man. We talk about everything that's going on with us because that's what it's about. You know, there was a wonderful woman when I got sober named Donna Croslin. Donna would get up at podiums and say, "I celebrate the festivals of my life from the podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell you the good news and the bad news, and that's the way we stay sober." And I believe that. I believe that. I tell you what's going on with me because there's somebody there who either needs to hear it or has the experience that I need, you know. One of the problems I see that's happening lately in Alcoholics Anonymous is with all the psychotherapy and all the treatment kind of stuff, is that people, when they're in trouble, go outside the program to get help and come back and say, "Well, I was in real trouble, and then I went and saw my shrink, and now I'm okay. And I don't know what happened." I don't know what happened, and I need to know. That's why I'm here. I need to know how you solve problems. I need to know how you stay married. I need to know how you hold a job. I need to know what you do in all the things of your life so I can apply it to mine. That's what we do here. We share our experience, strength, and hope. We don't get up and talk about what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now in 5 minutes and sit down. That's nonsense. That night, Linda got called on. She got up at the podium. She started out with some happy horseshit about how grateful she was to be sober. And I was sitting in the second row looking at her, and she made the mistake of catching my eye, and she's a little scared of me, and she started talking about it. And what she said is, I've been diagnosed with cancer, and I'm terrified. And she started to cry. And she sat down, and after the meeting, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened. 5 women from the room, from 5 corners of the room, came and formed a circle around her. And they all shared their experience, and they walked her through the next 6 weeks. They became inseparable, this little gang. And 6 weeks later, I saw Linda at a meeting, and she was looking good. She looked great. And I said, Linda, remember that stuff I told you 6 weeks ago? And she said, yeah. And I said, tell it back to me, because I'd just been diagnosed with cancer. And she told it to me, and she said, if they ask you to share... You tell them what's going on. And they asked me to share. And I got up and I said, I got cancer, man. And I'm scared to death. And I sat down, and at the end of the meeting, 5 guys came from the 5 corners. And they talked to me about their skin cancer and how they'd done it. One guy said, I had the same operation in the same place 30 years ago. It's going to be okay. And they walked me through it. And they continue to walk me through it because it ain't over. I keep going in and they keep taking little chunks of me away. A little melon scooper. Sew me up. I'm starting to look like a railroad map of New Jersey. I've had to give up my night job as a stripogram. But I found everything that I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am one of those lucky people who's never had to go anywhere else. Because I have always believed that this program works. And if you don't believe it, examine it in yourself. I have found the solution to everything I've ever needed to know because for some reason I've been too stupid not to ask. You know, when I've been in trouble, I've said, this is what I'm going through. Has anybody gone through this before? And you've always been there. You've always been there. And so I'm grateful to you. I'm so grateful to you. This is the only place I can be taught. So for me to get on a plane this morning and get here... Thank God. I just want to tell you. I just want to tell you how honored I am to be in the company of my teachers. Thanks.